All right, welcome to Friday Night Light. Good to have you guys here. I know there's some visitors here tonight, so welcome to Door of Hope, too. It's great to have you guys here. My name's Tim. I'm one of the pastors here. And just by the fact that you are here on a Friday night to do something like this means that you are fully joining the ranks of like Bible geeks or something like that. So is that okay with you? Yeah, like so you're giving up your entire Friday night basically to come learn about the history of the making of the Bible. That's like you probably aren't going to tell too many of your friends about that tomorrow. So anyway, so it's great to have you guys here though. As I'm a confessed Bible geek, and this is just it's a topic. It's an issue that's really has been an important part of my own kind of faith journey and following Jesus. And I was just talking with someone earlier. We were talking about a common friend who just has a healthy skepticism towards all things to do with Christianity. And I really respect that and really like it when I come across people who just have a healthy skepticism about everything in life, because there's a lot of really dumb things that people get taken in by, and Christianity is not one of them, I don't think. And so this whole issue about where the Bible came from and so on, this is really, I think, in your journey of following Jesus, there is some point where you need to think this issue through, if somehow this book is going to play a central role in our lives as followers of Jesus. So there you go, one Friday night. Really, I just think of tonight as kind of just starting, at least trying to inviting you onto a journey of discovery. And there you go. It's going to be, dude, so much information, like crazy amounts of information. So before we get started on anything, totally didn't quite think this many people would show, so I didn't make enough handouts. So I've got another round burning out on the copy machine. It's the 21st century, you guys. Who does paper? So we're totally breaking our third pillar rule by printing out materials. You know this by giving you. So go to the front page of our website. You click on that picture on the front page of the website, and the handout will, boom, appear before you. And you can follow on your gadget or whatever. Or if you want to destroy a tree branch or whatever, go ahead and Josh will get the... My assistant Josh will get the handouts to the MacBook table in a few minutes. So yeah, there you go. I think those are my comments. You guys ready for action? So it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose for the next few hours. And what we're going to do is there's kind of three deep dives that we're going to take. So we'll take one deep dive into the making and the history of the making of the Old Testament. And we're going to take a break for a few minutes, hang out, get some more coffee. Do the same for the making of the New Testament. It'll be the second deep dive, and then our third deep dive will be the collection and the making of the Bible as a collection, what's called the canon. So it's kind of three sessions, and there you go. We'll just kind of see how long it takes. Sound good? Great. So we're going to take our first deep dive here, and I'll kind of begin by setting the playing field. This drawing is by whom? Yeah, M.C. Escher. So I grew up with a big, fat M.C. Escher coffee table book in our living room that my parents had. My dad was a graphic artist and a graphic designer. And so, you know, M.C. Escher, everything is about visual puzzles, right, and visual paradoxes and so on. And so anyway, I just love his drawings because they're just imprinted on me from a super, super young age. And so this image, it's called Drawing Hands, has kind of come to mind throughout many different points throughout the years of being a follower of Jesus, because the Christian worldview has a number, at its heart, has a number of paradoxes. And by paradoxes, I don't mean contradictions. Paradoxes are, there's two things. I see this claim and I see this claim, and how they go together is very complex, and I can't always give a completely rational explanation. It doesn't mean that Christianity is irrational, just the opposite. I think it's actually a very reasonable worldview to adopt. But there are some paradoxes at its heart. And what exactly the scriptures are is one of those. And so we're going to look at some different biblical passages and so on about this, but kind of the core claim of Christianity and Judaism, for that matter, which is where the Old Testament came from, is that this is both a divine and a human book. So, and what has happened throughout history in Judaism and Christianity is that one of those hands gets worked out more, gets way stronger than the other and obliterates the other one, or something like that. So that would be another drawing, I don't know, of like bashing, one hand bashing the other or something. But what typically happens is that some people, they somehow have a view of the Bible where the human processes and history of how it came into be are minimized in some way. And so, you know, I kind of call this the golden tablets falling from the sky view of the Bible, as if it just kind of dropped in, you know, bonded plastic leather from the sky, you know, just down. And usually it goes along with a view of what the Bible is, namely a collection of divine commands about how we all should behave and how horrible we are because we don't behave that way. That's what most people perceive the Bible to be about. And that's essentially the view of the Bible. And so then what happens is because, say, people grew up in a religious context or church setting or kind of whatever, they maybe go to university or community college, they take a Bible as a literature class, and all of a sudden they realize what they hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then they learn about the history of the making of the Bible, and then their faith is just on the verge of collapse because there's all of this, like, scribes and manuscripts, and it's all very complicated and so on, and I thought it just fell out of the sky, right? And so I cannot tell you that at the church where I was at in Madison, Wisconsin, it was a university church, right, near one of the biggest Midwest state universities, University of Wisconsin in Madison. And when I was a pastor and a student there, I can't tell you how many cups of coffee I had with college students whose faith is about to collapse because they had no categories in their mind for the fact that this didn't fall out of the sky, that there is actually fully human processes behind it. And so that's one piece. Mainly what we're going to focus on tonight are the historical, cultural, human processes behind the making of the Bible, because I find people to be mostly just kind of, you know, just not aware of that, and it has so much to inform our faith. So that's kind of one hand that often gets emphasized, and then in different settings, simply the human hand gets emphasized, and well, because we can trace the history of the making of the Bible, and because we can know a lot about its processes, then, well, we don't need any divine explanation at all, because we can just trace its history. And I think that's equally in error and neglecting the content and the effect that these texts have had on God's people throughout the centuries. And so in my mind, one of the paradoxes is how can a book be fully divine and fully human? There's an analogy to this in the Christian faith. It's actually even a more significant paradox, right? So it has to do with this guy named Jesus, you know? And so, right? And so Jesus' claim about himself and what his followers have been hashing out for millennia now is that he is fully human, but yet he is fully God. He did not drop down out of the sky like an alien speaking a language no one ever spoke before. You know, he grew up in like the rural hill country of Galilee, and he spoke Aramaic. And he like pooped his pants, you know, as a baby, and he got like colds, whatever, and he stubbed his toe, and he grew up. He had lots of brothers and sisters, but yet the kinds of things that he said and did pointed to some greater reality about this man, Jesus of Nazareth. And so, actually, I think that's the core paradox at the heart of Christianity is that Jesus is God with us. And so in many ways, I found Jesus and the scriptures as helpful to think about in analogous ways like that. Just as Jesus is divine in such a way that it doesn't erase his like history and his background. And we should totally like get after that stuff as his followers. And at the same point, that doesn't cancel out the fact that he was God in the flesh. And something similar, I think, is going on with the scriptures. So, you know, I don't know, I don't make any assumptions about who's in the room right now. You may be a Christian, you may not be, whatever. But I just, what we're going to do is focus in on the historical processes and then come back around at the end of the evening to the divine question. But I just wanted to put that on the table because I'm guessing for most of us, questions about the Bible are somewhere in the mix of how those two relate to each other. Any nods of affirmation? Yes, somehow? Yeah, yeah. So there you go. So that's kind of what we're going to focus in on, human processes, and then come back around to the divine question. Okay, there you go. There you go. And maybe I should say a bit about myself before we dive into this too. So I became a Christian when I was almost 20 years old, and it was fully related to, I was flushing my life down the toilet, bad, bad decisions, and I had a number of people that loved me, cared about me, and in a very powerful, loving, relevant ways, you know, confronted me with the gospel in the best way possible. And so it was not an intellectual decision, first and foremost, but after a few years, as I kind of got into this and I was reading the Bible really for the first time, and I was like, this thing is so weird. This is so weird. It's a weird book, you guys. It's really weird. And the questions begin. And pretty much they still are there, and the questions keep coming. And somehow the Lord paved a path for me to go to 14 years worth of schooling to pursue these questions. So, I just say that to say these are really important questions to me. There's no such thing as a stupid, insignificant question when it comes to the Bible or to the making of the Bible. It's complex. As you're going to see tonight, the history of its making is complex. But the message that it speaks is both complex and simple, which is why it's so beautiful. And so you have some kind of motivation for being here tonight. And chances are the questions that you have, you may not know it, they've been asked before by tons and tons of people. And there are lots and lots of answers out there, lots of material, lots of reading, lots to reckon with. And so tonight's just kind of one dive into those questions. Okay, I'm not going to stop talking, but I'll stop the intro. So here's what you've got. Whether you're looking digitally at that handout, or where's my assistant? Hey there. Did the handouts? Do you know? Oh, you have been. Do you not have a handout? There you go. Yeah, there you go. Well, yeah. Yes. Oh, got it. Yeah, what we'll do is I'll take breaks, and then I'm just going to hang out here, and then come ask me your questions, and then I'll kind of bring those up as we begin the next session. Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Andy. I appreciate that. Thank you, Josh, my assistant, Josh. So the last two pages of your handout, whether you're looking at it digitally or in print, I'm going to have a timeline that's going to be kind of the framework for everything we're doing here tonight. And so there's a two-sided timeline that you have on your handout, the last two pages. Almost everything that's going to be on the screen in terms of text and the main points and so on, they're in your handout. So what's bonus about what's on the screen is pictures of manuscripts and that kind of cool thing. So hey there.
Can I get some hands?
I see that hand. All right, so we're gonna focus in. Let's just kind of get a big picture here. The Bible, as you kind of pick it up, you go to like Barnes and Nobles or something, and you get a Bible, and it's bound in one nice volume here. So I have this is an updated NIV translation. It's bound in what it says bonded leather, which means like plastic cheap leather, right? And so. If you're Josh, you will only use like an animal goat leather fine Bible or something, but I don't care, like whatever plastic leather, it doesn't matter to me. So we get one off the shelf and it's like, it looks like one book, and we say the Bible teaches or the Bible says, and we view it or treat it as a single volume. But you open up to the page of contents and you realize, oh, there are actually two different collections of literature in the one Bible. And they come from two different times. They have different histories and processes of how they were made. So this is very just big picture here, but you just look kind of on the timeline. So the Old Testament, what it's called in Christian tradition, the Old Testament, in Jewish tradition, either Tanakh, which is a word that you'll understand by the end of the evening, or the Hebrew Bible. And so this is a collection of books that was written and formed, just do the math there, over how long a period of time? Yeah, over 1,000 years. So So just pause and let's just let that soak in for a second. America has been in existence for, like a little over 230 years, something like that. So 1,000 years, the Old Testament was in the making. This is a long time. That's a very long time. The New Testament is a collection of books that was formed surrounding the events connected to Jesus of Nazareth. And all of the New Testament books were written within a time period of 50 years, 50 to 180. So just let that sink in. These are two very different little libraries. So the Bible is actually like a library, is what it is. Even though it's bound in one volume, it's a library with two collections of literature that are separated by history, and they have their own kind of stories behind them. And so even though we're talking about the Bible in the making, we have to do the Old Testament in the making and the New Testament in the making, because they're in different languages with different histories. So we're going to hit the Old Testament first. Sound good? All right, good. Let's dive in. So let's begin with the good news, which is this. We don't know who produced the final edition of the books in the Hebrew Bible, nor do we know when. So isn't that great? What a great starting point, right? It inspires confidence, right? So, but that's not, in other words, here's what that means. The books in the Old Testament, while they are connected to individuals, the book of Isaiah is connected to the prophet Isaiah. The first books of, five books of the Old Testament are connected to a figure named Moses and so on. But nowhere in the Old Testament do you read, hey, reader, here I am. I'm so-and-so writing this book on this date at this. You don't have that. What you have are anonymous prophets or scribes collecting and shaping material that comes from or is rooted or connected to these particular individuals. And so what you have to do then is look within the stories to find little clues about how these books were made. And so you get a little clue like this in Exodus chapter 17, 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. And, you know, your little assistant, Josh. What? Your assistant, Joshua? That's what Joshua was. Your assistant, Josh, make sure that Joshua hears it. So what's happening in this story, this is a battle. Israel has just come out. They're a band of escaped immigrant slaves, right, out in the wilderness now, fleeing from the Egyptian oppressors. And then there's another group of people who sees them on the road. They're called the Amalekites, and they're like, sweet. Look at all this booty, all this plunder. And so they just attack them. And so the people of Israel end up winning the war. And this is what God says to Moses. You got to write this down. Don't forget the story of this great deliverance that God did for his people. It's something to be remembered. So even within the book of Exodus, you get a little clue. Well, here's where that story came from, right? Moses was told to write that story down. It's almost, you get the idea that biblical books are more, we'll talk about this later in the Gospels, they're like really majestic quilts with all kinds of little pieces that have different origins and stories behind them, and that they've been sewn and arranged together into a larger picture. You get another little clue, like at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, which says, it came about when Moses finished writing the words of this law in a book until they were complete, Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that's a little golden box with some animal creatures on top with wings, and it says, it was kind of like the hot spot of God's presence for the people of Israel. It was empty inside. And so take this book of the law and place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may remain there as a witness against you. So what's the purpose of writing things down? So that they are remembered, right? You don't forget. And here, and what Moses goes on to write is a little poem about how Israel is such a corrupt, screwed up people that they're going to abandon Yahweh. And so he says, write this song so it can be as a witness to remind them that it's a big I told you so beforehand, essentially. All right, so write it down so that 200 years from now, you know, the prophets can look back and say, we told you so, right? We told you this was how it was going to go. So it's a witness. You write things down as a witness. This one's really interesting. Okay, the book of Proverbs, for example. The book of Proverbs in the Old Testament is typically associated with what figure in Israelite history? Solomon. And that's for a very good reason, because it begins with These are the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel. That's how the book begins. So you go, oh, okay, this Solomon wrote this book. Apparently, it's a collection of Proverbs. Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs. You get to chapter 25, and there's a little heading that reads this. It says, well, here's some more Proverbs of Solomon. They were compiled by the men of Hezekiah, who was another king, king of Judah. Now, this is real Bible geek history. How far separated in history is Hezekiah from Solomon? So, not quite, but great guess. Just 400, you know? So it's about 250 years. Now, just stop and think about that. So what the book of Proverbs was like a snowball. And there was an early form of the snowball that was formed in Solomon's time. But yet, over a process of 250 years, the book of Proverbs was still taking shape, attracting more Proverbs, as it were, as it rolled down the hill. And so there was an important, another rolling down of the hill that the book of Proverbs took 250 years later with these scribes hired by the king of Judah, Hezekiah, who are collecting more. And then it gets really weird. Look at the last chapter of the book of Proverbs is connected with who? It says, these are the sayings of King Lemuel, an inspired utterance that his mother taught him. So who's King Lemuel? So no, absolutely nobody knows. No, nobody knows. Was not a king. He was not an Israelite king. He was a non-Jewish king, and he's not known from any other ancient text in the ancient history. So, which shouldn't surprise us. There were loads and loads of kings that we don't know about and whose memories we don't have anymore. But apparently, like, his mother's Proverbs made it into the book of Proverbs through this guy. So he was a friend of Solomon's, maybe? We don't know. And Solomon heard it, or King Hezekiah heard it, and he goes, that's legit. I'm going to put that, you know, put that in the book of Proverbs. So isn't this interesting? So in other words, we often think of the Bible as connected to, here's how I think most people have a view of the Bible, is, well, it's the golden tablets out of heaven or something, or maybe some golden tablet ideas dropped into a prophet's mind or something, and then they're like taken up in a trance, and they're just like, you know, like going like this, and have, but no, apparently the book of Proverbs is a collection of Solomon's wise sayings, and then 250 years later, another collection of sayings added to it. But then also, like, hey, you know that guy Lemuel? Remember what his mom used to say? That's so wise. Let's put that in, you know? And so, in other words, the divine origin of the scriptures may use all kinds of different people in the process of the making of the Bible. In other words, what's divine is not necessarily that every person who wrote like any part of the Bible or something went into a divine trance or something like that. What it means for the scriptures to be divine, particularly, is that they speak exactly what God wants his people to hear. And in the Bible, God speaks through all kinds of different people, through an ass, for example. Right? So it's like, that is a joke, but you guys know what I'm talking about. Through Balaam's donkey, you know what I'm saying? So that's a weird story. It's very weird, right? And Paul the Apostle, he quotes all kinds of Greek philosophers and so on. That's part of the Bible. So this shouldn't bother us at all. This is how books are made. And that God should use a book like this to speak his word to his people, that's great. That's awesome. I want to hear what King Lemuel's mom has to say, you know, don't you? So it's very interesting. This is another good one. Jeremiah chapter 36. This is great. So actually, we should set the context here. So Jeremiah, he was one of the prophets of Israel. He was around the scene in the 600s BC, and he was on the scene right before Israel just totally got attacked and taken over by the big superpower of their day, King of Babylon. And Jeremiah saw this coming, and he was warning the people of Israel, turn back to the Lord and so on. This was one of the times when the Israelites had adopted the practice of child sacrifice, and Jeremiah knew this contradicted everything God ever wanted for his people. So he railed against that and so on. And nobody wanted to hear what he had to say. And so he collected all of his poetry into a book, we're told in chapter 36, and he sends it in a scroll to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel listens to it, and he's so ticked, he has his scribe cut it up and throw it into the fire. And so God says to Jeremiah, you better write another scroll because there needs to be a witness of my word spoken through you. So here's what we're told here. So Jeremiah took another scroll, and he gave it to Baruch, the son of Neriah, the scribe, and he wrote on it, at the dictation of Jeremiah, all the words that King Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that was the bad guy, had burned in the fire. Okay, now let's stop real quick here. So who wrote the book of Jeremiah, or at least some early version of the book of Jeremiah, according to this? So not Jeremiah, right? Baruch, this guy Baruch. And so scribes this was a paid professional class. This is a career that you have in the ancient world as a scribe. So literacy was not nearly as widespread as it is today. And so you could get trained for it and so on. This is a full-on, like a viable, is a prestigious career. So on. So this guy is a scribe, and he's Jeremiah's scribe, and he's a good friend. You can read more about him in the book of Jeremiah. And so you get the idea. Jeremiah's recounting to him again all of the prophecies, and Baruch is writing it down. Now look at the last sentence there. He wrote down all the words of the book that Jehoiakim, king of Judah, had burned in the fire, and many similar words were added to them. Well, what does that mean? Like, whose words? Whose words? Is it more of Jeremiah's words that weren't in the first version? Is this, whose words? It's just totally unclear. You know what I'm saying? Is it like, did Jeremiah have some other friends who were prophets? There were lots of prophets on the scene, some of them bad, some of them good. Were other oracles and poetry of other prophets put in there and so on? Because you read Jeremiah, it reads like you're walking through a museum and it's just like, whoa, it reads like a mishmash, like just a collection, hodgepodge at certain points. So we don't know. We don't know. What it does mean is that Jeremiah is at the root of this book and God's word through him. But there were other scribes or prophets involved in the formation of the book. This shouldn't bother us. It's like it's in the Bible itself that we hear about this. Now, this is really great. So I'll show you lots of pictures and so on tonight. And so there are just ongoing excavations and so on going on in and around Jerusalem and so on. And so a lot of times they'll just dig up, you know, under the foundation of some building. They want to make an apartment in Jerusalem or something. They'll dig up for the foundation, and they're required by law there to, once they dig in anything in the ground, to pause and let all the experts come and sift through the dirt and so on before they can do anything with it. And so they find all kinds of crazy stuff in the dirt that they dig up from Jerusalem. And so a few years ago there was found this. It's a fossilized, it's a seal is what it is. And so in other words, this is a piece of clay that has been hardened and fossilized, and it's of a ring seal. You guys know what I'm talking about, like a soft clay, and then somebody has a ring with an insignia on it, and then they would seal up a scroll and then put the clay over the edge or something and then, you know, push the seal in, and then only that guy is authorized to open it or do what he wants with it and so on. And so this is a little piece of clay that got broken off from a scroll and, like, put in the dirt, and it was buried in the dirt like 2,700 years, something like that. And so it was dug up, and lo and behold, whose seal is this? Look at that. This is belonging to Baruch, son of Neriah, the scribe. And here's what's best. Do you see the thumbprint lines right here? So this thing's really tiny. And so what Baruch did is he pushed, you know, took off the ring and pushed the seal into the clay. And as he did, his thumb rolled over the top. Do you guys see that right there? Do you see it? Those are the ridges of a thumbprint. So this is the fingerprint of a biblical author. How awesome is that? You know what I'm saying? It's so rad. So there's nothing else like this. This is the closest we are to something of like the fingerprint of somebody who played a role in shaping the book of Jeremiah. So this is totally unique and awesome. Also, just a side note, if you've seen Hebrew before or whatever, or maybe you're one of those people, you have the Hebrew tattoo or something like that, so it's okay. There's some cool Hebrew tattoos. Oh, you guys, we're recording this? So, well, we need to edit this part out because, and I know, but none of you know her, and you'll never, so my sister, she lives far away, none of you will ever meet her. So she has two kids, and she got their names, one on each shoulder, in Hebrew. And she sent me pictures yesterday. It's not their names. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Yesterday, I got this picture. So my niece's name is Lindsay, and her shoulder says Miriam in Hebrew. And my nephew's name is Tim, and she named after me. And it says Hadar, which means splendor or majesty. So anyway, so bummer, total bummer. So what's interesting, here's why I'm telling the story. Most of you have probably seen the Hebrew alphabet somewhere out there, you know, on tattoos or something like that. And it doesn't look like this, I'm guessing. So the Hebrew alphabet that's used even in the, I've got a bunch of Hebrew Dead Sea Scrolls Bible stuff, I'll talk about this in a few minutes up here. And the alphabet that it's written in is actually an alphabet that emerged actually roughly around the time of Jesus. This was the original Hebrew alphabet right here. It looks much more kind of like caveman scratch than the modern Hebrew alphabet. Anyway, it's actually quite beautiful and so on. But anyway, this says belonging to Baruch, son of Neriah, the scribe. Isn't that awesome? Yes. Don't tell any. I'm not even going to tell you my sister's name. You don't even need to know. So there you go. So there are lots of little clues like this. Like passages that I just read, we can multiply by that by a number, I don't know, by 10 or something like that. Little clues that you can get within the books about the origins, about they had multiple steps, multiple people involved in the making of the biblical books. But eventually, we know around 200 BC, final editions of the final books are written, and this thing is collected into a unity. So here's another fact. So we don't have the originals. We have little clues in the text about how they originated, but we don't have the originals. So if we don't have the originals, the natural question is, well, what do we have then? Because here we are, like we're way off the map. We're like here or something. You know, we're sitting here in the 21st century. And so how do we connect these books written by the prophets and so on to us who are sitting right down here? You know, you go pick up a Bible at Barnes and Noble's. How do we connect the timelines? And there's ample material to connect the timeline. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus in on three important sets of manuscripts. You've heard of one for sure, the Dead Sea Scrolls. You've heard maybe of the others, but there you go. So this is an effort to connect the dots. You guys with me? Yep. Following here? Okay. So we're going to start with the latest collection of manuscripts first. So this is called these are a group of manuscripts called the Masoretic Text. And just we'll kind of move through the points here. These guys were total heroes. They're amazing. So this was a group of Jewish scholars. They were all rabbis or rabbis in training of some form. And they were literally the preservers of the text of the Hebrew Bible in Jewish tradition during a crucial period, during about a 500-year period or so here. And so all of the manuscripts that we have produced by these scribes come and date from this period here. So here's what's super crazy. So they were so meticulous about the preservation of the text that they were passing down. They counted verses, they counted paragraphs, they counted the verses, they counted word numbers, they counted the number of letters, and so on. And so, you know, you finish your Torah scroll and you go like get it checked out with like the guys working in the office next door, and they're like, "Yeah, you're three letters short, dude. Sorry, you know. Sorry, cut that. Start over." They were that meticulous. So, kind of the crown jewel of all of the manuscripts of the Masoretes, these guys were called. In my grad school days, there were two priorities in our life: rent, groceries, and books. And so Jessica allowed me to purchase it's literally like a photocopy facsimile edition of the crown jewel of the Masoretic manuscripts. It's called the Leningrad Codex. I'll show you some pictures up here. So this is the oldest, not oldest manuscript, but the oldest complete in one cover to cover of the Hebrew Bible all in one piece together. There's loads of manuscripts that are way older, but this is the oldest complete version right here, and it's just epic to look at, right? Totally epic. So I have it up here, and it's awesome. So for example, here's how crazy they were. And if you, how many, do you have a Bible? Do you guys bring Bibles? If you brought a Bible, once you get it out, we're going to look at a couple points. If you didn't get a Bible, that's okay. You'll be able to hear me read aloud or whatever. Turn to Leviticus, a book I'm sure we were all reading this morning, chapter 11, Leviticus 11. Leviticus 11 contains a number of rules about the diet of the ancient Israelites, things they were allowed to eat and things they were not allowed to eat. And chapter 11, Leviticus 11, verse 42, says this. It says, "You are not to eat any creature that moves along the ground, whether it moves on its belly or walks on all fours or on many feet. It is unclean." Now, there's a lot to say about the food laws and so on. We're not going to say anything about them right now. Here's what I want you to look at. Do you see that word belly or stomach, your translation? Do you see that word there? So that word has four letters in Hebrew. The third letter is the letter Vav. It's the simplest letter to write in the alphabet. It's just a straight vertical line, a lot like our capital I, just like this. And that letter is the center letter of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. In other words, if you count from that letter in Hebrew backwards to the beginning of Genesis 1, you will get a certain number of letters. If you count from that letter forward to the end of the Torah, the end of Deuteronomy, you will find the equal amount of letters. And if you look in this manuscript right here, that letter is, they've made it extra big. So you look at that line and there's a little extra space above and below it because they've made that third letter of that word. So this is how insane these guys are, right? This is just what they do. So I always like to think, I mean, you have to wonder like the personalities that would be attracted to this kind of career, you know what I'm saying? So, because this was a very prestigious, honorable career option. That sounds so modern, but this was an estimable way, what thing to do with your life in Jewish culture. There's a famous saying in the Talmud, one of the collections of writings of the rabbis, and says it's as if it's a father Masoret to a son Masoret saying, "My son, be careful, because your work is the work of heaven. Should you omit even one letter, or add one letter, the whole world would be destroyed." Right? So talk about pressure. You know what I'm saying? Like, to your little kid or something, you know, you're training him up. But so they took their work very, very seriously. So the text, the collection of manuscripts that come from these scribes in this time period, it's called the Masoretic Text. And the word Masoret is literally the Hebrew word spelled with English letters and from Masor. And Masor just means tradition, or that which is passed down, which is what they did with the text. So I'll kind of show you some pictures here just because it's super interesting. So what you have here is this is a page from Exodus 15. And you can see they've made the text into columns here, three different columns. Here's a paragraph break. So here's the main text. Now, what else do you notice on this page? Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff on the page, right? There's all these little dots and so on. These are also these are Hebrew letters, but they're little notes made in Aramaic. And then there's all of these little notes up and down at the bottom here. So here's what's going on. These guys were so crazy. They would, if you're reading along, you'll come across little dots and squiggles in between the lines. And those are essentially the equivalent of like footnotes in our text today, which means go see the side or go see the bottom. And so you'll be reading along and there'll be a little footnote referencing you to the side. And so what it means is this little comment here relates to the word with the squiggle over it. And so there'll be a little squiggle and it will say, go out here. And this will be, say, dear scribe, the next scribe who's working on this manuscript or copying it down, it'll say, this word spelled kind of funny. This word occurs 17 times. And then this will have little cross references to these cross references down here, and then they'll list the 17 other biblical passages where that word with that spelling, particular spelling, occurs. So it's unique spelling, might throw off the next scribe, so I'm going to make a little footnote. It's footnotes of footnotes of footnotes, and so on, is how these guys work. And every page is full of these little notes, and it's all just little detailed commentary about spelling, basically, so that people didn't mess up the spelling. And so this is all there to guide the next generation of scribes in 100 years when this thing wears out and the next Masoret needs to make a new copy from this copy, to do notes to guide these guys. And then they would do stuff like this, which is just awesome. So this is from Deuteronomy 28, and they would make just incredible artwork out of the words of Scripture. So this thing is awesome. Come look at it during one of the breaks. It's called the Leningrad Codex, and it dates to 1008 AD. It's the crown jewel of the Masoretic texts. So there you go. So here we're 2013. So we just made a jump of about 1,000 years towards the originals. Yeah? You guys with me? So, and it's in this beautiful, beautiful thing right here. Now, this thing didn't drop out of nowhere. It has a long history behind it, too. But that's the Masoretic text. I often wonder, you know, like, were these guys super introverts or whatever? You know, are they extroverts? I mean, you give your whole life to this kind of detailed work. Okay, so that's the first set of manuscripts. You guys with me? Okay, that's the first set. How do we close this gap right here, then? What do we have? Because essentially, this is the period, this is all post-Jesus and Christianity, which is all right here. So how do we close this gap? And lucky for us, we have a lot of material in here to close the gap. The second collection of manuscripts is connected not to Hebrew manuscripts at all. It's connected to a Greek translation of the Hebrew text of the Bible. And this Greek translation, so through a number of, I mean, Jerusalem just got pounded in ancient history. It got taken over so many times, it's just not even funny. And so the people of Israel were sometimes allowed in the city, sometimes not, depending on who was in control of it. Israel actually had the city of Jerusalem as their capital, you know, just for about 600 years or so, and then that's it. And there's been other people ruling through most of the city's history. And so because of that, many people in Jewish communities scattered across the ancient world. And so there was a large Jewish community in northern Africa, in what we call today Egypt. And there was a prominent city in the ancient world called Alexandria. Big, big community of Jews. And Greek is the spoken language of the day. Alexander the Great conquered the whole world and so on. Everybody's speaking Greek. So you're little Moshe or Esther, you're growing up in Alexandria, Egypt, and you grow up speaking Greek. You don't grow up speaking, nobody speaks Hebrew. And nobody speaks that anymore. And so the Jewish communities there said this is an issue because the scriptures, the ancient scriptures, nobody's reading them anymore. And so they translated them into the language of the day, which was Greek. So this translation of the Hebrew text of the Bible was made over a period of a hundred of years, kind of like the King James was made, but in that revisions are made, updating it, and so on. And so the history of the English Bible is really about a 500-year history or so, even though the main thing was started a long time ago. So that's kind of what's going on here. Now, this is complex because this was the Bible of pre-Christian Judaism in the Greek-speaking world. You guys with me? So the Hebrew Bible exists, but now you have a translation of the Hebrew Bible in the language everybody is speaking and talking and reading in. And that's called the Septuagint, or it's abbreviated with this thing, the LXX. You guys ever heard of the Septuagint before? Yeah, it's kind of, if you're into this kind of stuff, you know about it. So LXX, this is just the Roman numerals for the number 70, and the Septuagint is just the Greek word for the word 70, and it's because there's a legend, a little fictional legend about the origin of the Septuagint, that 70 Jewish scholars went into 70 different rooms, they all translated the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, into Greek from Hebrew. They all 70 met again, and their translation was exactly the same word for word. Wow. You know. So anyway, that's the great story about the origin of the Septuagint. So this was the Bible of pre-Christian Judaism. So Christianity comes onto the scene as a Jewish messianic movement, but within decades, it is just spreading across the ancient world like wildfire, because Jesus is not just a Jewish savior, but a savior for all of humanity. And so what version of the Old Testament are the Christians going to take up and begin using as the mission as it spreads throughout the world? So the Septuagint. So the Septuagint was the Bible, the Old Testament of Christianity, for the first couple centuries, until it was translated into even other languages after that. So the Septuagint is a crucial piece of evidence in the history of the Bible. And so here's what's interesting, is there are lots of differences between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. Now, don't let that throw you. What is the Septuagint? It's a translation. So it depends on like how just on his game the translator was. You know what I'm saying? So if he didn't have his coffee yet that morning, you know, he might make mistakes in copying the translation, he might skip a line or something, or he might just say, like, man, that's a really difficult, like all these weird animals in Leviticus 11. Let me just kind of abbreviate the list a little bit here. And so on. And so sometimes the translators would do this. So it's not a Hebrew text, it's a Greek text. Let me kind of give a picture here. It's a Greek text that's a translation of a Hebrew text underneath it. But that Hebrew text underneath it is like jumps our timeline gap. How far? Like all of a sudden we're at the doorstep of the final collection and making of the Old Testament itself. Right as the Old Testament books are being formed and brought into their collection, this stuff is being translated like within a couple decades. So this is a very, very ancient text witness, it's called, but it's complicated because it's in Greek. Okay, so some translators translated a lot, like just kind of paraphrasing it, and they would go, let me just get the idea of this verse in Hebrew and I'll put it into, you know, something else in Greek. Other translators were super hyper-literal, and it was horrible Greek. They would translate into Greek like nobody would ever speak, but it's great Hebrew in Greek. You know what I'm saying? So we have a translation like this in English. I think it's called the New American Standard, right? So if you've ever tried to read it, it's not English as anybody talks. That's because what they're trying to do is map the English as closely onto the word order of the Hebrew as possible. They're not trying to make it a super eloquent English translation. They're trying to get you as close to the wording of the Hebrews as they can with the English language. And so when you come across those translations, that's money right there. That's money. Because you can retranslate from Greek back into Hebrew. So which means you have to know Greek pretty well, and you also have to know Hebrew pretty well. So true confessions. So I had to do a dissertation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I chose the book of Ezekiel. And when you read the book of Ezekiel in Greek, it reads a lot like the New American Standard. It's very horrible Greek, hyper-literal. And when you compare it to the Masoretic text, it's almost word for word and so on. You can really map it super closely. But inevitably, there are differences. There are differences. And so my whole dissertation was mapping the differences between these two of one book of the Bible, the book of Ezekiel. And it was so fascinating. Really depressing some days, but it was so fascinating. And I don't think anybody will ever read it, but I sure learned a lot in the process of doing this. So this is really important. So let me kind of show you an example. You have an example on your handout. These are the kinds of differences between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. And we'll kind of pause on this one because it's pretty key. So this is from Genesis chapter 4, which is the story about the two brothers, yeah? Cain and Abel. Right? And so it's great. This is a great story for a lot of different reasons. Abel's name, oh my gosh, you guys, Abel's name is the Hebrew word hevel from Ecclesiastes. Why? He's here he dies in like sentence 8 of the chapter, you know what I mean? He is on the stage of the story and then he's gone. He's just taken off. He never says a word in the story. It's hevel. Isn't that a good word play? Yeah, it's good. All right, so but it's translated Abel. That's interesting. Okay, so if you're reading the Masoretic text, if you're reading in the Leningrad Codex right here, all of your English translations, modern English translations of your Bibles are based off of this set of manuscripts that they're photographs right here, the Masoretic text, the Leningrad Codex. So if you read it in MT, the Masoretic text, it says, Cain told Abel his brother. And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now let's just pause for a second there. Does that, in terms of like style of good storytelling, anything strike you as funny right there? Yeah, totally. What did he tell him? It's like, you know what I'm saying? And Everett said to Tim, and then they went to the store, and it's like, wait, what did Everett say to Tim, right? And then it's like, and then they, then, Cain, Cain told Abel, his brother, and it came about when they were in the field, just assuming that you know they're in a field. You know, the story has a gap in it right there. And it's puzzled readers for a long, long, long time. When you read this this verse in the Septuagint in Greek, here's how it reads. Cain told Abel, his brother, hey, let's go into the field. And it came about while they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. So this is, in the Greek, we have an extra bit here that just fits perfectly what we sensed was lacking in the Masoretic text. So that was standing there in the Greek translation for hundreds and hundreds of years. 60 years ago, the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered and show up, and there is found a Hebrew text of the book of Genesis, and this Hebrew text, guess, has what in it, in this verse? It has precisely this right here in Hebrew. So what this is showing is that this Greek translator, like, didn't miss his cup of coffee that morning. He actually was looking at a Hebrew text older than the Masoretic text that had the original version of the story. Somehow, let me get back to the timeline here, somehow in this gap here, that line fell out in the copying of the Masoretic text. And if you look at it in Hebrew, there's really similar letters that begin and end the words right around that. It would be very easy for a scribe, he looks at the first part, copying it down, and then his eye skips over that to the next part. Super easy to make that kind of mistake. So that's precisely what's happened. So here's what's interesting then, is that this Greek translation has preserved for us a Hebrew text that is older than the Masoretic text. And in this case, is more original, more original. How you guys doing? You guys tracking with me? So this is great. The Septuagint's awesome. It's so important for understanding the history of the making of the Bible. So here are just some pictures of ancient fragments of the Septuagint. So this is from pre-Jesus, a Greek translation of Deuteronomy, preserved here. These were found in Egypt. Here's some other pictures. So this is a collection of the Greek translations of the Septuagint that were put together in a number of what were called codexes or books in the ancient world. Most of them were originally made on scrolls, but later they were collected into books. And actually, these codexes of the Septuagint, they have such a fascinating story. One of them was discovered in the basement of a monastery in Sinai, Egypt. And there's a famous story of, like, it was this kind of famous archaeologist and so on. He was going, they had this whole library down there that no one had ever looked at. And he's down there, and he's noticing that they're using paper from the manuscripts to patch holes in the walls and stuff like that. And he discovers this ancient manuscript of the Septuagint. It was like ready. It was out and ready to be used to have the paper reused and stuff like that. Anyway, it's crazy. So really glad that he found that one. So there you go. So that's about where we're at for the Septuagint. Big closing of the gap here. There's some problems around it, challenges to it, because it's a Greek translation, but it's super, super important. Okay. How you guys doing? With me? All right. So we still got a gap here. We still got to close the gap. And most of that gap gets closed for us by the Dead Sea Scrolls, which most of us have probably heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah, it's a cultural phenomenon. So this is how the basic story goes. It's so fascinating, and it was full of intrigue. It's such a great story. So 1947, a number of ancient Hebrew scrolls show up on the black market, and there's a newspaper ad placed. It's so crazy. But essentially, the whole story, in summary, is that after the first manuscripts surfaced, they were traced to their source. They were traced back to these caves near the Dead Sea. I'll show you pictures. And more caves were found connected to them in kind of this labyrinth kind of network. And essentially, out of these caves were found thousands of pieces of ancient Hebrew manuscripts, all of them dating to the time of Jesus and older. And many of them were pieces of biblical manuscripts, all sorts of other things found as well. So a virtual tour, you guys with me? Who doesn't love a virtual tour, right? So here's, you've kind of seen maybe a map of the land of Israel before. So this is the Mediterranean Sea. Here's Jerusalem. And it's really hard to tell here, but basically this is sea level right here, right? It's the Mediterranean Sea, it's coast. And this is not super far. This is like This is about 50 miles inland right here. This is right here. It's not super far. So, you could drive this distance up to Mount Hood. And it would take you longer to drive to Mount Hood than it would take you to drive this right here. But what happens is you go from sea level right here to about 3,000 feet in elevation up here. Jerusalem's up in the hills. And then in this set of about 15 miles right here, you drop down to about 1,000 feet below sea level. Does that make sense here? So you're climbing, and then all of a sudden Jerusalem's up in the hill country, and then just down, super crazy, down to the Dead Sea, one of the lowest points on the earth, and in terms of elevation. And then this is the Jordan Valley up here, the Jordan River. This is the Sea of Galilee, and then this is where Jesus grew up in these hills up here. So this is the area where all of the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and this is the hot spot here. It's a little set of ruins called Qumran. And so these are the hills going up to Jerusalem. This is the plain of the Dead Sea Plain, and you can just barely see the tip of the northern edge of the Dead Sea. And coming out of these hills are these ravines. They're called wadis. And it's so dry there, it rains like 3 days a year or something. When it rains up in the hill country, it rushes down and all collects, and you know, about 2 or 3 days out of the year, there's flash floods that just carve these crazy ravines out of the dry hillside. And so this is a set of ruins that had been sitting there, and people knew that they were there, but they had been sitting there on the edge of the Dead Sea for a long, long time. And these are the ruins. This is a Jewish community that about 100 years before Jesus, they were convinced that everyone else in Judaism and Jerusalem was apostate, that they had, you know, abandoned the Torah, abandoned Yahweh altogether. And so they withdrew into a little desert enclave here. They withdrew from Jerusalem to a desert enclave, and they set up a new little, almost like a monastery-type camp here. And lucky for us, they took a whole bunch of copies of their Bibles with them in scrolls. And so these are the remains of, like, their little grounds here. This is a reconstruction of, it was like, almost like a little fortress. And they had gardens and so on. This little thing here was their eating hall and so on. There are like animal bones found in there and stuff. There was a whole little section of halls for Torah study. And because there were ink pots and little quills and pens found in these rooms and so on. Super, super interesting. So this community lived here on the hills right above the Dead Sea. And this is essentially the story, is in 1947, there's these two Bedouin Arab shepherds cruising with their sheep out here in these flat plains. And as the story goes, a number of the sheep had gone down this little steep hillside here. And so they were, they sent a dog and were throwing rocks down, you know, past the sheep to try and scare them to get them to crawl back up the hills here. And some of the rocks started a little landslide down into these holes, these caves here, and they heard the sound of breaking pottery, shattering pottery in the caves. And so obviously, this is the story they told. They crawled down, and in these caves, there's all these like ancient pots and just leather manuscripts all over the floors. And they go to another cave, and it's the same thing. And so essentially what happened was the Romans came right after they destroyed Jerusalem, in 70 AD, and they came and wiped these guys out. And what most likely happened is as the Romans are marching up, the people who lived in these buildings, they came and hid all of their most precious possessions, their scrolls, biblical scrolls, here in these caves. And there you go. So here's how the scrolls became known to the public. It was through a Wall Street Journal ad, which said this. So these guys found them, and then sold them to a black market antiquities dealer, and they show up in the Wall Street Journal saying, biblical manuscripts, imagine seeing this, biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale. This would be an ideal gift to an educational or religious institution or by an individual or group. And then here's the address to write the response and so on. It's crazy, there you go. That was how they surfaced. And then, of course, all sorts of scholars and so on, people, archaeologists, they flocked on this and it all rooted down to the source. And eventually, over the next 10 years, the caves are all discovered and manuscripts of every book of the Hebrew Bible, pieces of it at least, were found in the caves, except the book of Esther, which is hard to know what to make of, because like even Lamentations, there's just a few little scraps. And just, you know, if a little badger or something had pooped on those pieces, they wouldn't have anything of Lamentations either. So it's likely an accident of history that Esther was not included. But all of them predate from precisely, now look at this time period. What does this overlap with? It overlaps with the Septuagint, doesn't it? These are Hebrew manuscripts precisely from the time that the Greek translators were translating from the Hebrew into Greek. So what this gives us is a window, a snapshot into this crucial time period in the history of the Bible. Right after, like decades, the century after it had been completed, we have manuscripts now from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's just absolutely unreal, just so unreal to look at these things. So for example, there's one from the book of Psalms, and I have a little, this was the first photographed editions of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of a handful of them. I have a little version up here that's really cool to look at, and so on. But this is the 21st century now, of course, so everything's online. Do you guys know this? The Dead Sea Scrolls are all in high-resolution online digital versions now. Do you guys? I'll show you the website in a second. It's so great. So you can get these beautiful photographs like this. So this is a copy of the Book of Psalms. Now, what do you notice about this? I mean, just look at the precision. You know what I'm saying? And they would go through and they would etch lines and so on. And this predates the Masoretes by 500 years. So these guys were introverts too, like doing their work and just working on the Bible. So that's a beautiful, complete version. Most of what was found were little scraps or something like this. This is one of the oldest manuscripts of the section of the book of Exodus. And it's in the old, more caveman-like script, not what my sister has on her on her shoulders. This is in the older script here. Okay, so here's what's great. These are some of the photographs taken of the original research team of like they go collect them in boxes and take them to a museum in Jerusalem. I mean, and just there you go. He's just like sorting it out. It's so crazy. And so they sort out, and they essentially put them all in glass plates. And there's tens of thousands of little pieces like this. So here's their job. Of this team. It was mostly a bunch of French Catholic scholars was the first team, and then they all burned out after about a decade. But this is essentially like, think of 1,000 different jigsaw puzzles dumped into one huge pile and all of the lids thrown away. You know? And that's, there you go. So you're like, I got a piece of ocean, and there's 100 pieces of ocean over there. Check the handwriting, you know, and do this, check the aging of the manuscript and so on. And so the last official edition, scholarly editions of the scrolls were just finished published in 2008. So it really took about 60 years to get all of these collected, arranged, put together in the right order and so on. An immense amount of work. Now here's what's great. This is one of the originalists named Roland DeVoe. Now just pay attention. What doesn't fit in this picture? Do you see it? He's smoking. He's like thousands of year old scrolls, you know, and he's just like, hey, you know, it's what you do. It was the 1940s, and so everybody's smoking. So let me just show you this because it's cool. Yeah. Here we go. So this is just deadseascrolls.org. It's great. And my connection, of course, is going to be uber slow right now. So this is the Leon Levy Dead Sea Scrolls Digital Library. This guy donated so much money to make this happen. But you can browse online high-res digital photographs of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls now. It's so awesome. At least I think so. It's the coolest thing ever. And so you can browse. What's interesting is to browse, they have the big biblical manuscripts, but Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, all this, you know, by caves, the different caves and so on. It's so rad. It's so awesome. And we'll look at some other pictures here. But anyway, it's great. DeadSeaScrolls.org. Awesome. Okay, so here's what the Dead Sea Scrolls do. They close the gap for us in a pretty significant way. And so there are a few other pieces that fill in our timeline, but for the most part, for the Old Testament, this is the body of material that we have. And so the big question then is, all right, so we've got three sets of manuscripts, later Masoretic texts, earlier Greek translations, and then the Dead Sea Scrolls. How do all of these compare to each other? And it depends on the book and the passage that that you're looking at. Most, so follow this here in terms of history, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls match precisely the text that we have in the Masoretic text. You guys with me? So how long of a gap, time difference is that? Almost all of these biblical texts match precisely this right here. So what does that mean? What that means is this gap is essentially closed for us. Because whatever these guys were doing, we knew they were introverts, and now we know these guys are introverts, and they did a great job. They did a really great job, right? So, but see, what this doesn't address is, what if there were changes or mistakes made in this early period, and the Masoretes are just one branch off of these, but there's other stuff in the mix here, because most of the biblical manuscripts match the Masoretic text, but some, like in the case where Cain and Abel, you have Dead Sea Scrolls that agree with the Septuagint, not the Masoretic text. Does that make sense? Okay, so most of the differences are insignificant. Some of them are so fascinating and really significant. So you've got one of the biggest ones, and I don't hesitate to show it to you because this example is almost not paralleled in anywhere else, but it's a great example. It's in Jeremiah chapter 10. And so here's essentially what you've got here, is that what's on yellow in the screen, or what's in bold italics here on the text in front of you, this is Jeremiah chapter 10. If you go open this up in your English Bibles are based off what manuscript? Off of the Masoretic text. I'm pointing my laser at the floor. That doesn't make any sense. The Leningrad Codex. So we also have the Septuagint. We also have a number of copies of Jeremiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so here's essentially how Jeremiah chapter 10 reads. What you have in front of you is what's in the Masoretic text. The bold italic material is not present in the Greek translation, the Septuagint. It's also not present in a handful of Dead Sea Scrolls, of precisely this chapter. Now, just read it with me. We're going to read it aloud. This is a chapter where Jeremiah is mocking the idols that the Israelites are going to worship and follow and so on instead of Yahweh. So, chapter 10, verse 3. For the customs of the people are false. A tree from the forest, it's cut down, and it's worked with an axe by the hands of an artisan. People deck it with silver and gold, and they fasten it with hammer and nails so that it can't move, so it won't tip over. Their idols, they're like scarecrows in a cucumber field. They can't speak. In fact, they have to be carried around because they can't even walk. Don't be afraid of them. They can't do any evil, nor is it in them to do good. There's none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For that is your due. Among all the wise ones of the nations and all the kingdoms, there's no one like you. They are both stupid and foolish. The instruction given by idols is no better than wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz. They are the work of an artisan in the hands of a goldsmith. Their clothing is blue and purple, and they're all the product of skilled laborers. But the Lord, he is the true God. He is the living God, the everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure his indignation. Thus you will say to them, the gods who didn't make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth and from the heavens. Now, did you see what's happening there? You see, so essentially this was a poem originally describing the making of idols. And at some point, whether it's from Jeremiah, whether it's from Baruch, remember that line in Jeremiah 36? Many similar words were added to them. Does Baruch add this material? In other words, he couldn't stand talking about idols before inserting a little worship song about Yahweh and how great he is and powerful he is. But what's interesting is that at some point, a version of Jeremiah split off that had this little poetry in it, put in by we don't know who, but there was an earlier version published at some point that also was copied and went out, and those two versions, they split ways. And so one ended up in the Septuagint, copied by them, and then one ended up in the Masoretic text. How you guys doing? Does this bother you? No, I'm quite serious. Does this bother you? Yeah. Yeah, totally. So, yeah, this kind of stuff rocked my world, you know? So I've been a Christian for numerous years, and then I'm getting into this. I'm like, dude, this is really, it's really complex. So it raises all kinds of questions about what is the original text. Well, is it the version that Jeremiah published? Like, who is this? Who put this in here, you know? So was this under the inspiration of the Spirit as well? It's sure awesome. It doesn't make the passage worse. You know, actually most of the stuff that's added here in bold italics here, it's actually little words and phrases that are taken from the book of Psalms and from other prophets and so on. It's actually it's sort of like, oh, you remember those great commercials in the 80s where it would be like an advertisement for a couple albums? It would be like a couple sitting by a fire, and then the titles of the songs would be going up the side. But then it would be like just little five-second clips of all the different songs and so on. That's how this section reads. It's like a little thing from Book of Psalms, a little thing from Isaiah 60, a little line. And whoever inserted this was bringing all of what the Old Testament has to say about God's character in contrast to idols and imports it right here. So there you go. This is how Jeremiah chapter 10 snowballed and took shape. And this has to fit into your view of the Bible as human and divine. And that this chapter speaks exactly what God wants his people to hear, even though the composition of the chapter has a complex history to it. Hang with me. So we can see the mechanism. This is from the scroll of the book of Isaiah. And you can actually see, do you see the main text here? And then what else do you see on this picture? Yeah, what's going on here? You know, and what's going on up there, right? And up here. So a number of things happened. One is, if you look super closely, this handwriting is different than this handwriting and different than this handwriting. So there were two scribes working on this Isaiah scroll. They call it Scribe A and Scribe B. So Scribe A, as just like you would too, you would make mistakes. You would skip a line. You would leave it out. Scribe B comes along and says, oh, that's not good. So just insert the missing material right here. So that the scribe who comes along next will incorporate all of it into a nice new complete text and so on. And so this is how the texts were produced. So here's conclusions. I think these are the conclusions that are reasonable to draw from all of this together here. Is that we have everything we need to recover the biblical text. The timeline, the gaps are almost entirely closed. In other words, we don't have too little of the Bible. We actually have too much of the Bible in a certain sense. We have 110% of the Bible because scribes, whether if they made mistakes, they would leave out a line or something. But if they were going to do anything like here, scribe might make an addition or so on. But you can check other manuscripts and say, oh, that's an addition, right? That may, and then you have to get into the details. Was that original? Was that second edition? Was that Jeremiah or Baruch? And so there's whole debates and so on you can have about that. But it's not like there's nowhere where there's a whole section of a book gone and we don't know where it went or something like that. We wouldn't know if we didn't know where it went because we wouldn't know that, you know, because it's missing. Right? So, but actually what we have is 110% of the Bible. And so in Judaism, but particularly in Protestant Christianity, there is a now 500-year-old tradition of information and scholarship and commentaries working on all of this. And there's not too many surprises left that haven't been discovered, really. And so if you're interested, you can go buy, like just at Amazon or Barnes & Noble's, commentaries on specific biblical books that will work through the manuscripts and the text and get us back to, as best as we can, the original text as we're able to recover it. And so what you have to do is come to a place where you come to M.C. Escher's Drawing Hands. And it's at the heart of a Jewish and Christian view of what it means for God to speak to us. In other words, In a handful of places, you get people hearing a voice out of heaven or something like that. That happens quite rarely in the Bible. Most often, God speaks to his people through other people and through prophets, chosen figures whose words and messages became a vehicle of the divine word to his people. And that's precisely what the Bible is. So this shouldn't scandalize us. We should expect this. If God's, he's going to stoop to our level and speak to us through humans, that's a theological idea called accommodation. God is accommodating to human history to speak to us, though we should expect this. This shouldn't bother us. In fact, in many ways, this really encourages me personally, because what this excludes entirely is that there was ever like a little secret room of five people, like old men with white beards, and just like conspiracy theory, stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, no. Like, these books come from many different periods of time, lots of different people involved. The history of how they were passed down, it's all public. We know much of the history. But it is complex, and you've got to wrestle with that. And so, just kind of a conclusion for the Hebrew Bible. Most Hebrew Bibles as they exist today, in printed editions, this is page one of Genesis, from official edition of the Hebrew Bible that I've got one up here if you want to look at. So what they'll do is they'll have the text. They'll reproduce all of the Masoretes' crazy notes out here, the little footnotes. But then what they'll do is they'll publish at the bottom all of the different manuscript readings for every verse of every book of the Bible. Here's what the Septuagint says. Here's what the Dead Sea Scrolls say. Here's what the Masoretic text says. And you can put together the math. And so all of the information is there if you're so inclined to go to school for 14 years and learn about this kind of thing. But I've come to love this part of the scriptures and their history. It's beautiful and it's messy. And holy cow, like, life is messy. You know what I'm saying? If God's going to roll up his sleeves and get involved in human history, we should expect this, right? I would be suspicious if it was golden tablets falling out of heaven. You know, that's weird. So this is how I would expect it to be if God were to use humans to speak to other humans in history. So there you go. That's the Hebrew Bible. How you doing? Fire hose off? Take a break?